Chapter 2. The Disposal of a Stranger. Loa Maron and her stolid husband, Arbin, played cards in the cool of the same evening, while the older man in the motor-driven wheelchair in the corner rustled his newspaper angrily and called, "Arbin!" Arbin Maron did not answer at once. He fingered the thin, smooth rectangles carefully as he considered the next play. Then, as he slowly made his decision, he responded with an absent, "What do you want, Gru?" The grizzled Gru regarded his son-in-law fiercely over the top of the paper and rustled it again. He found noise of that sort a great relief to his feelings. When a man teems with energy and finds himself spiked to a wheelchair with two dead sticks for legs, there must be something by space he can do to express himself. Gru used his newspaper. He rustled it. He gestured with it. When necessary, he swatted at things with it. Elsewhere than on Earth, Gru knew, they had telenews machines that issued rolls of microfilm as servings of current news. Standard book viewers were used for them. But Gru sneered silently at that, an effete and degenerate custom. Gru said, "Did you read about the archaeological expedition they're sending to Earth?" "No, I haven't," said Arbin calmly. Gru knew that, since nobody but himself had seen the paper yet, and the family had given up their video last year. But then his remark had simply been in the nature of an opening gambit anyway. He said, "Well, there's one coming, and on an imperial grant, too, and how do you like that?" He began reciting in the queer unevenness of tone that most people somehow assume automatically when reading aloud. "Bell Arverdon, Senior Research Associate at the Imperial Archaeological Institute, in an interview granted by the Galactic Press, spoke hopefully of the expected valuable results of archaeological studies which are being projected upon the planet Earth located on the outskirts of the Sirius sector, see map. Earth, he said, with its archaic civilization and its unique environment, offers a freak culture which has been too long neglected by our social scientists, except as a difficult exercise in local government. I have every expectation that the next year or two will bring about revolutionary changes in some of our supposed fundamental concepts of social evolution and human history." And so on and so on, he finished with a flourish. Arbin Maron had been listening with only half an ear. He mumbled, "What does he mean, freak culture?" Loa Maron hadn't been listening at all. She simply said, "It's your play, Arbin." Gru went on. "Well, aren't you going to ask me why the Tribune printed it? You know they wouldn't print a Galactic Press release for 1,000,000 Imperial credits without a good reason." He waited uselessly for an answer, then said, "Because they have an editorial on it. A full-page editorial that blasts the living daylights out of this guy, Arverdon. Here's a fellow wants to come here for scientific purposes, and they're choking themselves purple to keep him out. Look at this piece of rabble-rousing. Look at it." He shook the paper at them. "Read it, why don't you?" Loa Maron put down her cards and clamped her thin lips firmly together. "Father," she said, "we've had a hard day. So let's not have politics just now. Later, maybe, huh? Please, Father." Gru scowled and mimicked. "Please, Father. Please, Father. It appears to me you must be getting pretty tired of your old father when you begrudge him a few quiet words on current events. I'm in your way, I suppose, sitting here in the corner and letting you two work for three. Whose fault is it? I'm strong. I'm willing to work. And you know I could get my legs treated and be as well as ever." He slapped them as he spoke, hard, savage, ringing slaps, which he heard but did not feel. "The only reason I can't is because I'm getting too old to make a cure worth their while. Don't you call that a freak culture? What else would you call a world where a man can work but they won't let him? By space, I think it's about time we stop this nonsense about our so-called peculiar institutions. They're not just peculiar, they're cracked. I think..." He was waving his arms, and angry blood was reddening his face. But Arbin had risen from his chair and his grip was strong on the older man's shoulder. He said, "Now where's the call to be upset, Gru? When you're through with the paper, I'll read the editorial."
"Sure, but you'll agree with them, so what's the use? You young ones are a bunch of milksops, just sponge rubber in the hands of the ancients."
And Loa said sharply, "Quiet, father. Don't start that." She sat there listening for a moment. She could not have said exactly what for, but Arbin felt that cold little prickle that always came when the Society of Ancients was mentioned. It just wasn't safe to talk as Gru did, to mock Earth's ancient culture, Why, it was rank assimilationism. He swallowed earnestly. The word was an ugly one, even when confined to thought. Of course, in Gru's youth, there had been much of this foolish talk of abandoning the old ways, but these were different times. Gru should know that, and he probably did, except that it wasn't easy to be reasonable and sensible when you were in a wheelchair prison, just waiting away your days for the next census. Gru was perhaps the least affected, but he said no more. And as the moments passed, he grew quieter, and the print became progressively more difficult to place in focus. He had not yet had time to give the sports pages a detailed and critical perusal when his nodding head lolled slowly down upon his chest. He snored softly, and the paper fell from his fingers with a final, unintentional rustle. Then Loa spoke in a worried whisper.
"Maybe we're not being kind to him, Arbin. It's a hard life for a man like father. It's like being dead compared to the life he used to lead."
"Nothing's like being dead, Loa. He has his papers and his books. Let him be. A bit of excitement like this peps him up. He'll be happy and quiet for days now."
Arbin was beginning to consider his cards again, and as he reached for one, the pounding at the door sounded, with hoarse yells that didn't quite coalesce into words. Arbin's hand lurched and stopped. Loa's eyes grew fearful. She stared at her husband with a trembling lower lip. Arbin said,
"Get Gru out of here, quickly."
Loa was at the wheelchair as he spoke. She made soothing sounds with her tongue. But the sleeping figure gasped, startled awake at the first motion of the chair. He straightened and groped automatically for his paper.
"What's the matter?"
he demanded irritably, and by no means in a whisper.
"Shh, it's all right," muttered Loa vaguely, and wheeled the chair into the next room.
She closed the door and placed her back against it, thin chest heaving as her eyes sought those of her husband. There was that pounding again. They stood close to each other as the door opened, almost defensively so, and hostility peeped from them as they faced the short, plump man who smiled faintly at them. Loa said, "Is there anything we can do for you?" with a ceremonial courtesy, then jumped back as the man gasped and put out a hand to stop himself from falling.
"Is he sick?" asked Arbin bewilderedly. "Here, help me take him inside."
The hours after that passed, and in the quiet of their bedroom, Loa and Arbin prepared slowly for bed.
"Arbin," said Loa.
"What is it?"
"Is it safe?"
"Safe?"
He seemed to avoid her meaning deliberately.
"I mean, taking this man into the house, who is he?"
"How should I know?" was the irritated response. "But after all, we can't refuse shelter to a sick man. Tomorrow, if he lacks identification, we'll inform the Regional Security Board, and that will be the end of it."
He turned away in an obvious attempt at breaking off the conversation. But his wife broke the returning silence, her thin voice more urgent.
"You don't think he might be an agent of the Society of Ancients, do you? There's Gru, you know."
"You mean because of what he said tonight? That's past the limit of reason. I won't argue about it."
"I don't mean that, and you know it. I mean that we've been keeping Gru illegally now for 2 years, and you know we're breaking just about the most serious custom."
Arbin muttered, "We're harming no one. We're filling our quota, aren't we? Even though it's set for 3 people, 3 workers. And if we are, why should they suspect anything? We don't even let him out of the house."
"They might trace the wheelchair. You had to buy the motor and fittings outside.
Now, don't start that again, Loa. I've explained many times that I've bought nothing but standard kitchen equipment for that chair. Besides, it does not make any sense at all to consider him an agent of the Brotherhood. Do you suppose that they would go through such an elaborate trickery for the sake of a poor old man in a wheelchair? Couldn't they enter by daylight and with legal search warrants? Please, reason this thing out.
Well then, Arbin. Her eyes were suddenly bright and eager. If you really think so, and I've been so hoping you would, he must be an outsider. He can't be an Earthman.
What do you mean he can't be? That's more ridiculous still. Why should a man of the Empire come here to Earth of all places?
I don't know why. Yes, I do. Maybe he's committed a crime out there.
She was caught up instantly in her own fancy.
Why not? It makes sense. Earth would be the natural place to come to. Who would ever think of looking for him here?
If he's an outsider. What evidence do you have for that?
He doesn't speak the language, does he? You'll have to grant me that. Could you understand a single word? So he must come from some far-off corner of the galaxy where the dialect is strange. They say the men of Fomalo have to learn practically a new language to be understood at the Emperor's court on Trantor. But don't you see what all this can mean? If he's a stranger on Earth, he will have no registration with the census board, and he will be only too glad to avoid reporting to them. We can use him on the farm, in the place of Father, and it will be three people again, not two, who will have to meet the quota for three this next season. He could even help with the harvest now.
She looked anxiously at the uncertain face of her husband, who considered long, then said,
Well, go to bed, Loa. We'll speak further in the common sense of daylight.
The whispering ended, the light was put out, and eventually sleep filled the room and the house. The next morning it was Gru's turn to consider the matter. Arbin put the question to him hopefully. He felt a confidence in his father-in-law that he could not muster in himself. Gru said,
Your troubles, Arbin, obviously arise from the fact that I am registered as a worker, so that the produce quota is set at three. I'm tired of creating trouble. This is the second year I have lived past my time. It is enough.
Arbin was embarrassed. Now that wasn't the point at all. I'm not hinting that you're a trouble to us.
Well, after all, what's the difference? In 2 years there will be the census, and I will go anyway.
At least you'll have two more years of your books and your rest. Why should you be deprived of that?
Because others are. And what of you and Loa? When they come to take me, they will take you too as well. What kind of a man would I be to live a few stinking years at the expense—
Stop it, Gru. I don't want histrionics. We've told you many times what we're going to do. We'll report you a week before the census.
And fool the doctor, I suppose?
We'll bribe the doctor.
And this new man, he'll double the offense. You'll be concealing him, too.
We'll turn him loose. For space's sake, why bother about this now? We have 2 years. What shall we do with him?
A stranger, mused Gru. He comes knocking at the door. He's from nowhere. He speaks unintelligibly. I don't know what to advise.
The farmer said, He is mild-mannered. Seems frightened to death. He can't do us any harm.
Frightened, eh? What if he's feeble-minded? What if his babbling isn't a foreign dialect at all, but just insane mouthing?
That doesn't sound likely. But Arbin stirred uneasily.
You tell yourself that because you want to use him. All right, I'll tell you what to do. Take him into town.
To Shika?
Arbin was horrified.
That would be ruin. Not at all, said Gru calmly. The trouble with you is that you don't read the newspapers. Fortunately for this family, I do. It so happens that the Institute for Nuclear Research has developed an instrument that is supposed to make it easier for people to learn. There was a full-page spread in the weekend supplement. And they want volunteers. Take this man. Let him be a volunteer. Arbin shook his head firmly. You're mad. I couldn't do anything like that, Gru. They'll ask for his registration number first thing. It's only inviting investigation to have things in improper order, and then they'll find out about you.
No, they won't. It so happens you're all wrong, Arbin. The reason the Institute wants volunteers is that the machine is still experimental. It's probably killed a few people, so I'm sure they won't ask questions. And if the stranger dies, he'll probably be no worse off than he is now. Here, Arbin, hand me the book projector and set the mark at reel 6. And bring me the paper as soon as it comes, will you?
When Schwartz opened his eyes, it was past noon. He felt that dull, heart-choking pain that feeds on itself, the pain of a wife no longer by his side at waking, of a familiar world lost. Once before he had felt such a pain, and that momentary flash of memory came, lighting up a forgotten scene into sharp brilliance. There was himself, a youngster, in the snow of the wintry village, with the sleigh waiting, at the end of whose journey would be the train, and after that, the great ship. The longing, frustrating fear for the world of the familiar united him for a moment with that 20-year-old who had emigrated to America. The frustration was too real. This could not be a dream. He jumped up as the light above the door blinked on and off and the meaningless baritone of his host sounded. Then the door opened, and there was breakfast, a mealy porridge that he did not recognize, but which tasted faintly like corn mush, with a savory difference, and milk. He said, "Thanks," and nodded his head vigorously. The farmer said something in return and picked up Schwartz's shirt from where it hung on the back of the chair. He inspected it carefully from all directions, paying particular attention to the buttons. Then, replacing it, he flung open the sliding door of a closet, and for the first time Schwartz became visually aware of the warm milkiness of the walls. "Plastic," he muttered to himself, using that all-inclusive word with the finality laymen always do. He noted further that there were no corners or angles in the room, all planes fading into each other at a gentle curve. But the other was holding objects out toward him and was making gestures that could not be mistaken. Schwartz obviously was to wash and dress. With help and directions, he obeyed, except that he found nothing with which to shave, nor could gestures to his chin elicit anything but an incomprehensible sound accompanied by a look of distinct revulsion on the part of the other. Schwartz scratched at his gray stubble and sighed windily. And then he was led to a small, elongated, bi-wheeled car, into which he was ordered by gestures. The ground sped beneath them, and the empty road moved backward on either side until low, sparkling white buildings rose before him, and there, far ahead, was the blue of water. He pointed eagerly.
Chicago?
It was the last gasp of hope within him, for certainly nothing he ever saw looked less like that city. The farmer made no answer at all, and the last hope died.